This is 4:55 on Monday, Halloween. Good morning. Still no Halloween costumes. Just disappointed. I see. Alright, well, I guess computer science students are just not into Halloween this year. A couple things. One is, I don't know if you saw, I replaced the assignment. Sorry about that. Aaron pointed out that there were problems assigned that didn't exist, and I went and looked, and some of the ones that were assigned that did exist didn't make sense for what I wanted you to know, so it's replaced and postponed to allow that to happen. I hope nobody really invested a lot in the wrong problems, but if you did, you learned something, so that's worth something. That's what you're here for, after all.
The work is its own reward.
Work is its own reward. Learning is its own reward. Yes, absolutely. This afternoon, I am not able to be here for office hours, so no office hours today. Catch me Wednesday if need be. Questions? Yes. Run an example of what?
Like what the program does. Do you have a program that you could run and show us?
I suppose I do, but I would have to set it up. So I can't do it today, but I can do it Wednesday.
Okay, that helps. I'm trying
to. Yeah. Normally what will happen is if you don't interact with it at all, it will just do its thing and converge to the optimal routing tables, which it prints out. Well, which it doesn't print out, actually, until you send it a P. Send each of the routers a P command.
Well, if you don't send anything, it doesn't. It automatically does.
If you don't send anything, it should converge to the routing tables, but I don't think I ask you to print anything. I don't remember.
What?
So I guess I'm not understanding. The routers, when started, should exchange messages with each other to compute the routing tables.
And each router is its own console.
Each router is in its own console window.
So
right.
When you run the program, you run the same program again.
Right. Right.
When you run them, though, like, so the person you run is obviously going to no one knows will actually exist to connect to at that point.
Right, right.
So you should have to start all of your nodes within the 30 seconds or whatever, because that's when it's going to send out to everybody. That's what gets everything rolling. After the timeout occurs, the person sends out messages to everybody.
Right.
That triggers everything.
Right. So if they're not there, then they won't get that first message, but they should pick it up on the next go round. Or when they start up, they send out their messages as well. So one thing is you may have to deal with the fact that you get errors on those first messages.
I still haven't figured out what's wrong with mine, and there are new errors being shown. So I'll just send you that.
Okay. All right. So one thing that happened was we were looking at one of these, and I was reminded again of this behavior of connected sockets. Once you connect two UDP sockets, they only listen to each other. So if you send a message to a UDP socket, to a connected UDP socket from someplace other than where it's connected to, it will ignore it. So just be aware of that. Because you may want to do that for testing or something, and that's, it won't behave the way you expect it to. And Yeah. Expect to get some errors, and keep going. In this case, that you know, after you get an error, and you know that the system is running, you know, is doing what you want it to do, you still may get some errors from some of the socket calls, but keep going. Forge on. I'd say print out something so for your debugging activity you know what's happening, but don't die if you get in there. Right. So today we're going to talk about link layer addresses, the so-called famous MAC addresses that you see labeled on everything these days, and how we get from IP addresses to MAC addresses, which is what you need to have. So remember that you have a 32-bit IP address associated with each interface. That's a network layer address, and it's used by the IP routers to make decisions about where to forward a packet, right? When we talked about how this works, it looks at some prefix of the IP address, of destination IP address of a packet, and looks up in a routing table, and it says, I need to send that a particular link. But eventually get to a point where the packet has arrived at the destination subnet, and then what do you do? Right? Because then after that, we have to send it to an address that depends on the technology of the subnet, essentially. Each link layer gets to define its own link layer addressing scheme, and that's actually what is used to determine where the packets go. So that's where this MAC address, Media Access Control, it's kind of a funny acronym to use for something that's an address, but Media Access Control address comes in, and it's For a lot of networks, link layers, it is 48 bits, and it's configured usually as a hardware manufacturing hardware configuration of the devices. So if you turn your laptops over and look on the bottom, one of the things that you may see there is the MAC address for the wireless and wired network addresses. I don't know if mine has that or not. Yes. Two little stickers on the bottom. One for the wired network and one for the wireless. So with 48 bits, notice that we're into the sort of address space that can handle, what is that? That's 16 bits more than 32 bits, so that's 535 times 4 billion, so we got plenty of those. Except for the fragmentation that comes from, again, handing them out in chunks to manufacturers who don't use all of them. But still, there are plenty. So we're into the 100 trillion sort of range. Probably not. There are 7 billion people in the world, but still that's sort of millions of devices per person. I don't think we'll be there. oh, what happens if two of the same end up getting manufactured? Well, as long as they never show up on the same local area network, there's no problem.
Is there usually a clause where if they do, you can get a free replacement?
Oh, wow. I hadn't heard about that.
I think one of the IT guys before at work told me something along those lines. If there's ever a MAC address conflict,
then
you can, with the network card or something like that, then you can actually get a replacement from the manufacturer in most cases.
Oh, it would make sense. I mean, if that happens, somebody screwed up. So what happens if it actually occurs? This actually used to happen at Xerox when, you know, Xerox was the inventor of the Ethernet, and in those days manufacturing these devices was not nearly as automated as it is now. And so Xerox made these things and shipped them off to customers, and every once in a while, you know, probably just a handful of times over the 10-ish years that they were doing this, it happened that there was a conflict, often because the device failed in some way, right? So a bit got flipped from what it was supposed to be. And so what happens? Those two devices get very confused because they're seeing traffic intended for each other, and that isn't something that the upper layers are necessarily very well prepared to deal with. And it's worse because if you're using DHCP to configure the devices, then DHCP will say, oh, those have the same MAC address, so they should have the same IP address. And that happens actually more frequently. I mean, I have that happen on my home network when I reboot the router or something. But duplicate MAC addresses are not good. Okay.
I don't know if you know anything about this, but I was curious, do they sort of like track a time span for them? Because I assume there's stuff from like even 10 years ago that may or may not still be in use now. And it's like,
you're asking, do they garbage collect the old addresses? I believe not, because there are so many of them available. And if you make a mistake, then you sort of run into the possibility of collisions. And that's more trouble than a few addresses out of this huge space are worth. Okay, so every interface adapter has its own MAC address, and this is interesting. They are 48 bits, so that means 6 bytes long, and they're usually written with colons, not dashes, between the different bytes.
Yes,
colons. So this is a little odd. And they're written as hex bytes. So just to keep you confused, remember the IP addresses are written as bytes but decimal values. These are bytes, hex values. And they're 6 bytes long instead of 4. Okay. So where do you get them? Manufacturer licenses or buys a portion of the space, and then is responsible for assigning unique addresses within there. The MAC addresses are global, right? They're sort of any globally unique identifiers. So you can move around from one place to another. The original Xerox interneting protocol design used the MAC address as part of the network address. And IPv6 also has an option to do that. But it's completely not necessary because we have ways to go from IP addresses to MAC addresses. All right, so how do you get from an IP address to a MAC address? The protocol used for that is called ARP, A-R-P, and the way it goes is that when you want to know the MAC address of a device on your same local area network, you send one of these ARP request packets, and whoever has that IP address responds and says, here's my MAC address. It's real easy. You keep a cache of that in your local operating system and periodically forget it. Now, they say 20 minutes. I observe them disappearing in more like a minute. So let's see what we have here. That one. Oh, because I don't have the network running. All right, let's fix that. You can learn these translations all kinds of ways. So, so the command to see the ARP table, it's called, is just ARP, and you can look up specific hosts, or you can look up all hosts with the dash A switch, and the N switch tells it not to try to do address resolution. So if I just say ARP minus A, it actually comes up with a DNS name for the host. But otherwise, usually all you need to know is that that's the IP address and that that's the MAC address. Right. If you do say ARP. Okay. Rolling by. Still too long. So even though we often used switched networks these days, notice that the ARP requests are broadcast. And so my machine is seeing all of the ARP requests that are occurring on essentially the WSU wireless network, or maybe this part of the WSU wireless network. I don't know how they have it segmented. And so there's continuous ARP traffic going on, but I don't see the replies because the replies get sent to the requester. So each of the... Let me stop this so that it's not changing. What was that?
Why is the request who has...
Uh huh. Right.
Why is every single request for an IP address for the same?
For the same one, because the the one that's being asked for is the router on that network. And so that's what all these hosts on the wireless network want. They don't usually want to talk with each other. They want to talk with somebody on another network. And so the main thing that they need is the address, is the MAC address of the router. And it's not clear to me why I'm seeing quite so much of this traffic. It seems really surprising that there should be that much traffic for that.
The ARP is
so they can associate a MAC address with a IP address.
So, like, if I were to, I have a wireless card, like, I have, so I automatically get this IP address.
Mm-hmm.
What happens, I mean, every now and then, you can plug in Ether cable and wireless.
Uh-huh.
Is that what ARP is doing, is catching that?
No. ARP is used when you have a packet to send to somebody. You have an IP address for them, which you've gotten, say, through DNS. Okay? And you say, we're going to look here in a moment at how this works in the internet, in the internetworked situation. But just assume that machine is already on your same local area network. The electronics of the network send the packets with the MAC to a MAC address, and the electronics in the network interface do the matching on the MAC address, not the IP address. So I'm sitting here, I have an IP packet to send to you, I have your IP address. ARP, the job of ARP is to let me figure out what your MAC address is.
So the MACs are just for once you're inside the subnet.
Once you're inside the subnet, yeah. Okay. So we keep a local table of those, but it starts out empty. I start out not knowing what it is. And the way I find out is I broadcast one of these who has requests. No, this is machines on the network sending them as broadcasts. Because everybody's asking for the router's address. Now, I don't quite know why there are so many. It still seems like it's way more than there ought to be. But still, that's what's happening. I send out a broadcast that says, who has 134.121.159.254? Tell 134.121.150.230. So the reason I don't see the replies here is because once this machine gets that request, it knows where the destination is for it. So it sends a unicast reply. Okay? So I don't see that, right, on my machine. It's being sent directly to the machine that is asking the question. Yes. Between down the slot.
So, when it replies, it doesn't have to go, I need an ARP for that.
Uh-huh. Excellent question. That's yes. How does this work? What is the bootstrapping? Well, this guy already knows his MAC address. This guy himself knows his own MAC address. And so part of the ARP request tells the other guy that. So you don't get into an infinite querying situation. That wouldn't be...
You should only have to request that information one time, right?
Well, it says on the slide here 20 minutes, but...
Okay, but
you see, there are these multiple requests from the same host. Why isn't it getting an answer? That's what I don't understand. There just shouldn't be. What? Well, not at the ARP level. Not at the ARP level. We've already gotten past that by the time we're doing ARP, I believe. So I don't know what's happening there. It's interesting enough because it may be contributing to bad network performance, of course, to have that much noisy traffic.
So
yeah.
If the MAC addresses are used at the local, like, in your local subnet, then why have local IP addresses?
Why have local IP addresses?
You mean, like, you're saying that, like, you know, the router needs to send something just on its subnet and uses the MAC address to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then so, say, like, you know, so then what your local IPs, they seem close, you know, in
their function. So, by local IPs, do you mean the ones that you get when
Why
have internal? Because the all the higher level protocols interact in terms of IP addresses, right? So to specialize the protocol stack to just work over the link layer would complicate things. It's much better to be consistent.
They just added the local IPs so everything works smoothly, even though MAC addresses.
Well, no, you have your IP because that's what makes you reachable from the outside world.
I think what would better answer your question is that the IP address is more for sectioning and abstraction from the physical computer so that you can do other things with it. And on top of that, you can, like, for instance, we're running out of IP addresses, you can expand and go to, like, and not have to change everything.
Yeah, I'm not convinced I yet understand your question. What do you mean by local IP addresses?
So, like, your router will assign you, like, 128.0.1.2.
Okay. That kind of local IP address. Right.
So, to find out who, like, you know, out traffic coming from, you know, outside of the
uh-huh.
how, and uses the MAC to send it to the right person, then...
Ultimately, it uses the MAC, but first it translates it to one of these IP addresses. And the reason is just because everything's built on the IP addresses, right? Yeah, man. Oh, actually, you're not next. You're next.
I was wondering about the host requesting the ARP stuff. Does it just mean that it's trying to get somewhere that it can't, it thinks it's supposed to go to just certain different hardware?
Well, you would think so, except for the fact that so this repeated requesting behavior is often seen if the machine that you're asking for is not on the network. Exactly. But the thing is that we know that this one is on the network because I have an ARP entry for it.
Okay.
So that and because I also happen to know that that's the address that they use for the router. So. That's why it's strange. It isn't strange to see repeated ARP requests, but it is for a machine that's actually present.
Okay.
And now, Matt.
I was just going to expand. Like, what I think, the way I understand it, and you can clarify,
uh-huh.
The reason why they both use MAC addresses and use IP addresses is because it'd be more difficult to, like, figure out where you're going. Because if you just have, like, everything within the same subnet has the same IP address, like, to a
the same subnet part, yeah.
So it seems like it would be easier to be, like, oh, well, I need to go here, and so I can go here, and then spread out from that point.
Yeah, but that's already bringing in the internetworking aspect of things, right? Right.
Yeah.
If you're saying you're looking at part of the address in order to go here, then you're assuming internet working. And I think the question was really about what if I just want to talk on my local network.
Okay.
See, that and why not just use the MAC? Well, because the cost of doing so is the cost of specializing for that case is so much greater than the cost of wasting a few bytes of
right.
header on every packet. Okay. All right. Okay, so we're going to look now in detail. A wants to send to B, doesn't know the MAC address. So it broadcasts, as I said, an ARP query that we looked at, who has B's IP address, using the broadcast MAC address, which is all ones. And so everybody hears that, and you saw that. You saw my machine receiving all those packets. B receives that and replies to A with B's MAC address. But since it knows the MAC address of where A is, because it just got a packet from it, because like at the IP layer, at the link layer, we also send both the destination and the source MAC addresses in each packet. B knows where it came from and is able to directly reply. You cache it, goes away unless it's refreshed. And this is really slick. There's no administration at all required for this protocol. It's the neatest one of all. At least on an Ethernet. When you have a broadcast medium. When we were trying to do local area networks with ATM, remember ATM, the virtual circuit thing that we talked about earlier. When we were trying to do it with ATM, ATM is not a broadcast medium. It's a point-to-point medium. And doing ARP on that was a pain in the you-know-what, because there was no broadcast. You couldn't ask everybody the question. You had to ask somebody specific the question, so that meant you had to have an ARP server, which meant you had to have registration with the ARP server, and blah-de-blah-de-blah-de-blah, and there's no place to stand to get started. finding out where the ARP server is, so you have to configure it, so how does DHCP... okay, so having at least the limited ability to do broadcasts is really helpful to make all this work. Okay, if we're going to another LAN, let's just walk through this case. It's straightforward enough. Remember that the way you tell one subnet from another is you disconnect the routers, right? And so when, say, we want to send, where's A and B here? R. Do you see labels for A and B?
It's right on the screen of the computer. They're like red.
Oh, okay. There they are. Thank you. You can see better from that perspective. So A wants to send to B. They're on different subnets. So now you have exactly the situation we were seeing on my TCP dump, that A doesn't ask about B's address for using ARP. It asks about the router's address using ARP and gets back the MAC address and then sends there. And the router similarly then asks about B's IP address to find the MAC address and builds its table accordingly. So the router has to have ARP tables for both sides of things. Yeah?
If all of our computers are on IP addresses.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't we, and I mean, this is going to come down to not knowing the definition between the two of them, but are we technically going through like a gateway than a router?
So a gateway is, to my way of thinking, another name for a router. Okay. There's sort of a commercial distinction that's drawn. Often the home devices are called routers, right? And they do a lot more than just routing. I would think those machines should be more properly called gateways. But because they do firewall, they do NAT, they do all kinds of stuff.
I just thought like a gateway took you from one IP segment to another.
Yeah, the
is that technically what a router does?
That's technically what a router does.
Okay.
All right. at least in the vocabulary that I grew up with, and I think the one used in this book. So router is the generic term. It's the device that connects multiple subnets. All right. So here's the whole story. You want to send this IP datagram to B, but you know B is on a different subnet. How do you know that? That's something else we never looked at. Let's do this one. Host. Alright. So that's my desktop machine. I want to send a packet to it. Say I want to ping it. Ping. And it does that. Okay, fine. So I could send IP packets to my office machine from this wireless network. It's on a different network. How do I know it's on a different network? Let's do a couple of things. How do I know that my office machine, 69.166.48.65, is on a different network from this machine sitting right here? Well, I look at its IP address, and I look at my IP address, and I say, what is the network address associated with this IP address? In order to find out, I have to use this mask and this mask with this address to get the network address. Right? So if I do that, I get 134.121. Something or other, which I would have to sit down and write the bit patterns to figure out. But regardless, this subnet starts with 134.121, and that one clearly doesn't. That one starts with 69.166, so they're on different different subnets. So once I know that they're on different subnets, I say, alright, I'm going to have to use a router in order to get there. And to find that out, I have to look in my routing table, and you can, on a Unixy system, and I think on a Windows system as well, come to think of it, you can use the netstat command with the R switch to get the routing table. And the N again says don't try to resolve them into names. So let me make that bigger so it's prettier. Much easier to read if it all fits on one line. It did it for me. So my routing table says that things that are on 34.121.144 can be sent directly to where they're going. No gateway involved. Notice the term here is gateway. So, all right. So, router, gateway, whatever. Anyway. So anything that's on the subnet doesn't require use of a gateway. I should just send it directly. But the default value here is that I need to send it to 134.121.159.254. Okay? So once I know that's where it has to go, well, notice that that one actually does match that. You can't tell it again without writing out the bit patterns, but it does. That one is on that network, and it says send it directly. So once I find out where I have to send it to directly, then I can use ARP to get the MAC address for the router or gateway or whatever we're going to call it. Notice that I could probably, if I've done it recently, I can get that out of my cache. If not, I have to actually go through the dance of sending the ARP request. Okay, so then once I have that, I send it to the router. The router takes it out of the link layer frame, looks again at the IP address, and says, okay, in my routing table, what do I do with this? Right? And if it's got that network connected directly to it, then it's going to have one of those entries in the routing table that says send it to it directly. Or it may have a routing table entry that says send it to some other router, in which case we'll go through the whole thing again and find the MAC address of the other router and eventually get the packet there. Okay. We had a great discussion about this. I love all the questions. That really helps, I think, get this down. So any more questions about this or related things? No? All right. Well, let's talk briefly about Ethernet. So, and it's appropriate to do this on Halloween. I'll tell you why in a sec. Exceedingly appropriate. So the idea that Bob Metcalf had for the Ethernet was that you take a piece of coaxial cable, you remember that's the kind that has the braided wire around the outside and a solid core on the inside, and you connect to that by attaching a transceiver, transmitter receiver, to the coaxial cable for each machine that you want to hook up. And the clever thing about all of this was that he figured out how to attach those transceivers without actually having to cut the coax. And the device that was used for that was called a vampire tap, which is the Halloween connection, because it was a it was a very sharp pointed wire with a backing plate, and you sort of put this thing up against it and you screwed it together, and the insulated vampire tap would go in and touch the center connector, and then there was something that also connected to the shield. So you had an electrical connection to the shield and to the center connector. And this was done with coax that was about that big, around half an inch or so. And so it was sort of convenient to make those taps. The cable itself was a pain in the neck. And so at Xerox, when I worked there, the whole place was built on raised floors with this great big coax snaking around under the raised floor to all the offices, and you could pull up the panels and make these vampire connections onto that cable. So that network was really simple. It used the CSMA CD collision sense multiple access with collision detection. Carrier sense multiple access with collision detection that we talked about before. You implemented that in quite simple for the time, well, complicated for the time, simple these days, circuitry in the interface, and compared with the, like I said, the token LANs that IBM was trying to design at the time, it was much, much simpler. I remember when I worked at IBM Research until 1984, and just as I was moving, IBM's Zurich lab had given us some of their first prototypes of this token ring LAN. And the token LAN box was about like this big, okay? And you hook that to your computer. And the Ethernet boxes, when I went to Park, were like that big, okay? So that's often one of the, it turns out the size of things is often one way to get a very good sense of how much they cost, the size and weight of things. And so the fact that the Ethernet one was maybe an eighth or a twelfth of the volume of the token ring one said a whole lot about the complexity and cost of the two devices. Okay, so the original Ethernet was 3 megabits per second, and then the next one they built was actually, I think, 1.5 megabits per second downward. Why? Because they wanted something even cheaper to put inside the copiers that Xerox made, as the way that all the microprocessors in the copiers would talk to each other. So going slower was cheaper, but in fact what happened was that since the early 1970s, the speed has first increased to 10 megabits per second, and then 100, and then a gig, and now 10 gigabit per second Ethernet is available. Although at the higher speeds, you don't use the collision sense multiple access scheme. Instead, it's a switched scheme that is much more point-to-point in most cases. All right. So we'll talk next time about that, I think. So, well, not what we're going to talk about right now. So the original Ethernet was this bus form where you just tapped into the coax. Then there was a form that used what was called thin net, which was thin coax that had connectors at each point, and so you screwed in two connectors on each network adapter. That was convenient, but just about as prone to failure as the other thing. The vampire taps were cool, but they could fail in interesting ways. They could fail to make contact, or they could actually create a short circuit. And so now you have, think about this, you have a building 300 feet of coax or more winding around under the floor, and somebody just created a short circuit somewhere in that, and the whole thing just doesn't work anymore. All right, and now you've got to find the place that the short circuit is. Some long nights spent doing that. So the thin net was better, but then what happened was people said, we can actually do better than that. We will bring everything to a central point. And the earliest version of this star topology actually took the bus configuration and just shrunk it down to a few inches long, right? But it was still the bus-based thing. These days, what we do is we use a switch, and I will talk about switches next time, all right? Which means that essentially most traffic does not go to all the hosts, and instead, when you're talking to somebody, you're talking over essentially a pair of point-to-point links between the host, the switch, and the destination. Okay, that will end us for today. Next time we'll talk about how at a lower layer this all fits together into frames.